Succession number 27767, Reel 4.
Adrian Holloway, Reel 4. So you've bombarded the Libyan coast.
Yes.
That was the 1st of January, 1941.
On January the 7th, we put to sea and sailed westward with the whole fleet. When we got to sea, the commander told us that we were to go as far as west of Sicily and to take over a convoy of ships which was being passed through the Sicilian Narrows by the Western Mediterranean fleet. In other words, it had come from Gibraltar. And we were to look after it after it had come through the Narrows. Well, personally, I didn't think much of this. We'd not seen been attacked at all, really, except the firing from Bardia. But I was living in very much of a fool's paradise. Nothing happened for 2 days, and we steamed westward. And then came January the 10th, 1941, my 18th birthday. And it was one of the most dreadful days I think I've ever spent. At 7 o'clock in the morning, I was just about to go up into what was called the flag deck, where all the signalling was done from, to take a sight. We had to fix the position of the ship every day, and as a side digression, our mentor in that was none other than Instructor Commander Sidney B. Taylor, who was our mentor in navigation and so on, and we'd known him as been on the staff at Dartmouth, and he was very tough about this. He said, I don't care if you're propping up your eyelids with matchsticks. You'll fix the position of the ship every day. Otherwise, your leave will be stopped. Now, that was a very hard thing to do. At sea, we were on watch 4 hours on, 4 hours off, 24 hours a day. And in order to take a sight, you first got to find the blasted sun or the moon or the star, whatever you're going to take off. I always took the sun and the moon because I knew where they were, apart from the stars. It would then take you at least half an hour with Inman's log tables to work it all out. Also, you had to write up your journal, which was a record of the day's events, and which was inspected by the Snotty's nurse every week and the captain once a month. So by that time, and the fact that you'd had no sleep, it was really a very hard imposition, but still, we lived through it. Anyway, I was going up to take this sight, and I saw what looked like a large fin in the water. And I asked somebody what it was, and somebody said, oh, it's an aircraft that's been down. But it wasn't. It was the bow section of the destroyer Greyhound, which was been one of our escorting destroyers. She'd hit a mine, and all of her bows had been blown off. So she was taken in tow by the destroyer Mohawk, and I think the crew who were marooned in the bows were taken off also. But that was our first introduction to the danger that lurked underneath.
How big was that bow section?
Well, a destroyer of that class would be about 1,500 tons. I suppose perhaps there would be 30 feet of it or something like that, you see. But it was a thing that at that time I'd never thought of. I knew about bombs, I knew about shells and so on, and torpedoes, but I'd never thought of a mine. And, of course, we were very near Sicily, which was Italian territory. And it brought it home to me very, very much what a hidden danger was always lurking below the water. So that was that. And then there was a cruiser called Bonaventure, which we could see over the horizon, and she was engaging an Italian destroyer, and she sank that. They had an engagement just on the horizon, but you could just watch it. So those were two incidents very early on in the day. And then, about 12:20, I was just about to have my lunch, Brown Windsor soup, I seem to remember, when the awful bugle call of Rappel aircraft came over the public address system. And it goes like this, da 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 da. Everybody translated as, there's an aircraft overhead, there's an aircraft overhead. And you would shoot off to your action station, which is what I did. Now, I was still the midshipman of B turret. And, of course, there was nothing to be done in the turret at an air raid. There was a hatch in the top of the turret, which I'd never noticed before. And the crew of the turret, plus the officer of the turret and the midshipman of the turret, me, had to go up on top of the turret, and the ratings would man this 0.5 machine gun, which was nothing more than a pop gun. I mean, it was quite ridiculous. Be standing in full view of the attacking bombers. Now, this was the first time that I'd been bombed, and first of all, what happened was that an Italian aircraft came quite low, swooped quite low, and fired a torpedo at us. And somebody said, I hope it's not set to W. A torpedo can be set to imitate the letter W by going first one way and then the other, so that it fools the person who's trying to maneuver the ship to evade it. Anyway, this slid past us, thank goodness, and nothing happened. But then one of the ratings pointed to the sky and he said, there they are. And hanging up at about 5,000 or 6,000 feet were these aircraft, which looked just like sort of vultures, which they probably were, in the sense that they were looking down at the kill. And these were the Ju-87B Stukas, which had done such havoc in as advanced artillery in the French campaign. And they started down with their sirens going. And I've never heard such an awful banshee sound in all my life. It was terrifying. And they came so low that you could see the claws holding the bomb coming down underneath the aircraft, and then the bomb, quite oval, being released, and you watch fascinated as it came towards you. Well, they missed us, fortunately, and we were not the main target. But what struck me about all this was that it was quite ridiculous, myself and Barnes being there at all. I didn't know how. Nobody had taught me how to operate the machine gun. I was only there really as really under training again, and it was the most stupid thing, because not if it was a question of cowardice, but I'd have been far better inside the turret probably to try and relieve somebody who'd been killed and try and find out how the damn thing went. But there we had to stay. And Henry Barnes once shouted down to me and fell down on top of me, and he was a very heavy man, practically winded me, and I lay there. And then I thought, oh, my God, they'll think I'm afraid, which I was. I don't mind admitting. But I had to get up and stand there and just be shot at, which was too ridiculous. Meanwhile, there was an awful, devilish noise going on, because all the 4-5 anti-aircraft guns were going, and so were the pom-poms, which were these 8 machine guns all in a row, plus our own machine guns. That, when you take the whine of the attacking aircraft and so on, made it a noise out of hell. And then somebody shouted, Illustrious is hit. Now, that was our dear aircraft carrier who'd taken the aircraft at Taranto. And she'd obviously been the main target, because Hitler and Mussolini had realized that if an attack on Taranto could be made like that with the use of an aircraft carrier, the thing to do was to eliminate it. And this first bomb had hit her on the flight deck aft, and the heat was so intense that the flight deck was curling up. You could see it was red hot. And she began streaming smoke and started to... She'd obviously lost control, and she started to veer across our bows. Well, nobody wanted a collision with her because she was carrying tons and tons of aviation fuel. Anyway, we managed to avoid her, and she got another two hits. I think there were about 130 killed on board.
Where were you? Were you able to watch this? Could you see?
I was watching all the time, you see, from the turret.
Yeah. And what could you see happening on Illustrious?
Men scurrying backwards and forwards on the flight deck. That was the only thing. You couldn't see the carnage down below, of course. As I say, she was burning very fiercely and the deck was red hot. Must have been terrible that far. And she belched forth smoke and limped off towards Malta. Well, I suppose that there were some more attacks, and we thought that we'd been spared, but and Henry Barnes at one time said, "I can't think why they're not machine gunning us." And we found out later they had been, and that somebody in a similar position to us on X turret, which was on the quarter deck, two men had been killed. So had they machine gunned us from forward, I suppose we would have been killed. That was that. But I suppose the attack lasted about 10 minutes, but it seemed like 10 hours, and then we had to wait another hour before the all clear was sounded, by which time it was pretty cold. I mean, January in the Mediterranean is not all that cold, but when you take it that you've also been extremely frightened, it was a very cooling effect, I can assure you. Yes. And I didn't like to shiver because I thought they might think it was shivering with fright. But
so it sounds as though the war had taken on a completely different complexion for you.
Absolutely right, absolutely right. And, then we went back to the gun room, where, as I put it in my book, the soup was not up to standard. Then, after about half an hour, a friend of mine who'd been with me at Dartmouth came in, and he'd had a nasty experience because he'd been in what was called a HACP, a high-angle control position, where I was for quite a time. And there, you were down in the bowels of the ship. It was the forerunner of the computer, which was trying to direct the four or five guns. And the armoured hatch, down which you had to clamber into this tiny chamber, had jammed. And so he was stuck there, knowing that the ship was being bombed, and quite unable to get out, trapped like a rat in a trap. So that wasn't very pleasant. Well,
May I just ask, how did they handle the deaths of those two people in the X turret? Were you told what had happened officially?
No, we were only told quite later, much later. I think possibly it was due to the fact that nobody wanted to broadcast it, as it wouldn't have been very good for morale. I never saw them buried. I did attend one burial at sea, but there was a chap who died of natural causes. But I don't know what happened. It was such a confused day that, you know, you didn't and then about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, this awful rappel aircraft sounded again. And Henry Barnes and I and the machine gun crew waited on top of the turret as before. And we had another attack. But again, they missed us. They'd scored such wonderful hits on Illustrious. Perhaps it wasn't pressed home quite so much, but still it was just as frightening. And then, of course, it started to get dark, and by that time we could relax. And so we all trooped down below, and Henry Barnes was very kind. He had me into the wardroom to give me a birthday drink. And there, brought into the wardroom at that time, were one of the bullets which had been fired at us. Now, perhaps had been inside one of those men, I don't know. But it was discovered it was dum-dum bullets. Now, dum-dum would have been forbidden by the Geneva Convention because they explode inside you. And that was rather a charming discovery to have.
What was the atmosphere like in the wardroom? I mean,
well, of course, that was unknown territory to me. Mm. I was never allowed in, you see, except to be invited. Yeah. Midshipmen and sub-lieutenants weren't allowed into the wardroom. So for me it was quite an experience to be in the wardroom for a start, to be all among lieutenants and lieutenant commanders and commanders. Well, it was an atmosphere, I suppose, rather dramatically you would call it electric. Everybody was discussing and telling their own story. I think that was it, really. Excuse me a moment. So we got back to Alexandria, and minus, of course, our lovely aircraft carrier, Illustrious. Can you stop it for a moment?
Yes, sir.
Do you mind if I get a copy of my book? Soon after Christmas, we were joined by a fairly senior midshipman who'd come from the cruiser Shropshire. And that was Prince Philip of Greece and Denmark, who had done a term at Dartmouth with the special entry cadets. Philip lived just a completely ordinary life in the gunroom, just the same as any of us. But there was one quite amusing incident when Commander Reed came up to him just before an air raid was due to take place and said, Philip, how many are there between you and the Greek throne? So Philip looked a bit hesitant and then said, I don't know, sir, about 8 or 9, I think. Ah, well, said Commander Reed, I still think you'd better go and get your tin hat. after the horrendous Stuka attack, not a great deal happened until March 1941. That was the beginning of the Battle of Matapan. What happened about this was that once again, Enigma and Bletchley Park had come to the rescue of very senior officers, those who were in the nose to the source of the information. And our Commander-in-Chief Cunningham learnt that the Italian fleet was due to put to sea. He decided on a subterfuge, and at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he ordered his picket boat to be brought round to the gangway, and was seen to be going ashore in civilian clothes with his golf clubs over his shoulder. He drove to the sporting club, the golf course, and could be seen there playing golf. Sometime during the afternoon, he disappeared, and when it was dark, returned to the ship. which was then the battleship Warspite. The fleet then put to sea, and it was hoped that the Japanese consul, who was reporting everything that happened on our side, and also the Spanish consul, who were then both of them in Alexandria, and it was hoped that we would have 12 hours of secrecy, that we'd be gone, and when dawn came the next morning, they would see an empty harbour. The opposing fleets at Matapan were an Italian battleship, a formidable number of cruisers, and accompanying destroyers. Can you... Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'll have to... towards Crete, in which harbour, Tsuda Bay, we had refueled at one time, and it was later, of course, to become the most sought-after objective for the Germans in the Battle of Crete. The Mediterranean fleet made a wonderful sight, three battleships, an aircraft carrier, eight cruisers and 10 destroyers, as it steamed in all its glory towards what we thought was the direction of the enemy. Several aircraft had sighted the enemy, which appeared to be in two forces, one with cruisers and the other with battleships and cruisers. During the day, we were ordered to steam at full possible speed, all of 24 knots, which was all that Valiant could manage, towards our cruiser admiral, who was going to need support since the Italian heavy cruisers were shelling him with very unpleasant accuracy. After a while, however, we were told that we should rejoin the fleet, and so we did, making Warspite with the commander-in-chief ahead of us, then us and the battleship Barham. Come that evening, we had heard that there were enemy forces not far from us. But to those of us not in the know, we had no idea whether they were heavy units or maybe just destroyers. And it was really rather unpleasant to think that although we had 15-inch guns, that some of the 15-inch guns from the Italians might now be soon raining shells down on us. We were closed up at action stations from about 8 o'clock in the evening, and my action station by that time was the HACP, which I've already referred to as the high angle control position, which controlled the anti-aircraft guns. I didn't think that although these could be used at low level as well as high angle, that I would be required to do very much, since it would be the work of the 15-inch guns if it came to an action. Came 10 o'clock, and we were told that the enemy was very near. We were the only ship that had radar, and so we were relaying information about the enemy to the other ships by radio, shortwave radio. And just after 10 o'clock, we heard the announcement that the enemy was in sight, and then the whole ship shook. Now, it was very difficult for me down below to know whether it was we who were being hit or our guns that were firing. The ship shook so much that I thought 15-inch shells were tearing into us, and hoped that they wouldn't come near me. Then the bulkhead light, the firing went on, and we were also firing with our 4 or 5 guns, which were meant to have quite a short range. Sorry about this.
That's right.
Trying to remember. And I had never envisaged that our guns would be required. The range was about 5,000 yards, at which you could hardly miss. And the bulkhead light carries its own story, because there was a light in the bulkhead which was meant to flash if the main armament was hitting, and you were meant to set the instruments that the secondary armament, the 4.5s which we were controlling, would use that range as well. And after the battle, I was called by the chief gunner as to why I had not set that particular range, and I had to, what I had really done was to take that light out, because several times it had begun flashing when I'd been trying to get to sleep, and so I never saw the signal, but I merely told him we were so busy that we didn't notice the light. Well, after about 5 minutes, we ceased firing and turned away from the enemy. Of course, being right down in this hole in the bottom of the ship, we could do virtually nothing. But up top was a friend of mine, Sub-Lieutenant Parker, the Honourable Jocelyn Parker, who was the son of the Earl of Macclesfield. We had quite an aristocratic gunroom. And he was relating to me all that was happening, and he said, "You should have seen it. You should have seen it. It was just an absolute firework display. We've destroyed 2 cruisers. They never had a chance. Their guns were trained fore and aft, and in 5 minutes we sent them to the bottom." So naturally everybody was very elated. What we didn't know at the time was that the Italians had fired torpedoes at us, and we'd turned away in order to avoid them, because, of course, it was so stupid. We were using searchlights, of which Prince Philip was in charge at that time, and we need never have done it, because the radar had told us where they were anyway. After that, nothing happened for the rest of the night, but we came upon the scene of the battle the next morning, and there were dead bodies floating all around and so on. Being a battleship, we had no thought, of course, of picking them up. That had to be the work of destroyers, because we were far too important a target to stop and pick up survivors.
Were these the first bodies that you'd seen yourself?
Yes, they were, actually, funnily enough. Yes.
And they were British, were they?
No, Italians. Oh, no, nobody was killed on the British side at all. It was really a great victory, because in destroying these 2 cruisers, and later a 3rd cruiser, we altered the entire balance of sea power in the Eastern Mediterranean. But that's going too much onto sort of tactics, isn't it?
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah. So how long had the action actually taken?
5 minutes. 5 minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
It was quite incredible. Normally, one would never fight at night, because it's everybody is so vulnerable. But Cunningham was very good at manoeuvring the fleet like that, and the Italians were very incompetent.
Yes, I mean, you were vulnerable because you were using searchlights as well. I mean,
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, you see, we were a target too, because their destroyers fired torpedoes at us. All they had to do was fire at the lights.
Yes, yeah. It was a successful engagement.
Well, it was. It was a very, very successful engagement. Mm. And I think that the Italian Navy never really came out of harbour again. But they did something later on, which I'll relate.
Yes. Adrian Holloway, end of reel 4.